Hey everybody, it's JT. What is on your holiday meal shopping list? Well, I would suggest Painted Hills Natural Beef. It is some of the best beef in the world. And your friends and family will be thanking you for a long time if you serve Painted Hills Natural Beef for your holiday meals. And now you can buy it online just by going to PaintedHillsBeef.com. Use the code BBQNATION at checkout and save yourself 15% on your order. Give Painted Hills Natural Beef a place on your table this holiday season.
Let's go to Luke and Mark, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys.
It's Barbecue Nation with JT on a Northwest Lifestyle Weekend. Now here's JT on FM News 101.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Barbecue Nation here on the Radio Northwest Network. I'm JT, along with my master producer there, David Shurtleff. You know, this is the time of year I used to travel to Texas a lot, and I always looked forward to the barbecue there. But there was one place I never got to go to, and that was Louis Mueller's over in Taylor. That's close to Austin, if you don't know your Texas geography. But today we've got a special guest, and that would be Wayne Mueller. He's the grandson of Louis and the current owner and pit master there at Louis Mueller's. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, JT.
No problem. Now, Louis Mueller started back in 1949. It actually kind of started as a, like, just a regular grocery store, didn't it?
Well, it started as an adjunct to the grocery store.
Okay.
My grandfather found his way to Taylor, Texas, by way of the Safeway Corporation. He was transferred here as a manager for the local store. He performed that task for 10 years before setting out on his own. He bought a little regional red and white grocer.
Oh, okay.
It had a fresh meat market and produce section. The meat, you know, in 1946, you had spoilage issues because refrigeration wasn't what it is today.
Sure.
So the ways that you dealt with this spoilage was you took meat from the cabinet and you ground it into sausage. You dried it to extend its shelf life, or you cooked it for instant consumption.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, our history and vestiges of making sausage and cooking for instant consumption have carried on to today. And the restaurant really started as a little shack behind the grocery store in the alleyway, just serving out these meats, which, you know, the menu changed day to day, just depending on what, you know, where you were in the cycle of
yeah.
meat in the casing.
Yeah. But now that's obviously grown and it's, you know, world famous. And I'm sure your menu is pretty standard for you guys. It probably doesn't change that much from day to day anymore.
No.
But you have an interesting story too, Wayne. You kind of took a different path. You busted out on your own and went to school, a couple of different colleges, ended up in the advertising business, and then you got a call from Dad one day and said, "Hey, I'm going to slow down here. I want to retire. Would you come back in and help me?" Do I have that pretty correct?
Yeah, I started working in the restaurant when my father took over from his father in 1974.
Okay.
I was in the second grade. I was, you know, I represented what small town America, I think, was typical of the time. If you had a family business, it didn't matter if it was a farm, a ranch, a hardware store, a restaurant. Family members participated in the operations of the business to help keep occupational costs low, right?
Sure.
Operational costs low.
Sure.
So I was no different. I cleaned tables, bathrooms, washed dishes, took out trash, all of the menial duties of restaurant cleanliness. And after about 11 years of indentured servitude, I couldn't get out quick enough.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those, you know, not just figuratively, but physically ripping the rearview mirror off the car as you're leaving the city limits because you have no intention of looking back or going back.
Sure.
And so my journey, my quest began really in the science I studied civil engineering and architecture for 4 years before switching to business because I just wasn't moved by the engineering, though I was very interested in the math, the orderly conduct of physics and math. Got a degree in finance with a minor in accounting. I went back to school, received a master's with concentrations in marketing and economics and MBA. And while I was in graduate school, I started working for a minor league baseball team. And that was really my first career. I worked for about 10 years in professional sports, developing sponsorship models, algorithms to create pricing models for sponsorship inventory. So if you go to a stadium or a park, you clearly have outfield signage, you've got PA announcements, you've got program ads. All of these are sponsored by corporations. I was the one who came up with the valuations. So I did that for a number of years, worked for the Houston Rockets for a few years, and then ventured out on my own. I left sports and expanded my marketing reach by a marketing agency, which I did until my father called me home in 2007.
Was it a big transition, or was it easy for you to say, okay, I'm going to walk away from the sports marketing and do that, and I am going to go back home and help Dad?
I don't know. Maybe something changes when you turn 40. There's a deeper nostalgia. For me, being, I think, in the entertainment world, it's easy to lose sight of where you came from.
Yeah.
And therefore lose sight of who you are and where you're going. And I needed a bit more grounding. I wanted a bit more grounding. So coming back was still a difficult thing because I still had all of my memories of this small town and these sort of, like I said, indentured sort of underpinnings of what my time at the restaurant was. But my father never asked me to do anything before. He allowed me to go pursue my own career, my own dreams. He never asked me to promise him anything other than for me to do well and be happy.
Yes.
So for him to ask this request, it was a big deal. But it came on the heels of him receiving an America's Classic, James Beard, in 2006. I think only then did he really believe that he had some sort of legacy to protect, that he wanted it to continue, and I was the best option to make that happen.
Well, if people aren't familiar in the food business and the award sanctuaries of the food business, a James Beard is a big deal. And especially if I don't know if your dad ever was, you know, put in the running for one of those things prior to that, but winning a James Beard is a very big deal. And I would say, yes, I would agree with you. You do have a legacy to protect after you get something like that.
Prior to that, I think my father saw this as just a means to an end. It was a way for him to, you know, to provide for his family and, you know, to have a life. I was about to say a comfortable life, and in some respects that's true, but not if you were my father. Poor man. You know, in 34 years, he worked over 175,000 hours in this place. That's dedication.
Yes.
So if we wanted to see Dad, you know, not only were we working, but that was about the only time you would see him, was at the restaurant. So, you know, our interactions, I had strange interactions with my father because he was both employer and disciplinarian. You know, things that happened at work didn't stay at work, or things that happened at home didn't stay at home.
I get that. I came from a long line of family business, and I kind of got sucked into that deal too for a while till I finally said enough and went out and did my own thing. Real quick, we're going to take a break here, Wayne, and maybe you want to answer this on the other side, which would be fine. What's the one major thing you did learn from your dad?
Dedication to a goal, to a cause. Devout dedication.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big lesson there.
Oh, it's the biggest.
Yeah, it's
it will keep you focused in the harshest of times, and it will keep you grounded in the best of times.
To me, that's one of the most important things, is to stay grounded. I've seen an awful lot of people in my career. I've been around the TV and the movie business and the restaurant business and a lot of things. And staying grounded, I think, is probably the most important to me. So
I agree.
You can take that as people listening can take that with a grain of salt if they want, but I think it's true. We're going to be back in just a minute here on The Nation. More with Wayne Mueller from Louis Mueller's in Taylor, Texas. It is an icon, and a well-deserved icon. So we're going to talk some more with Wayne in just a couple minutes. Don't go away.
Successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams Payne's. No, I ain't going down on the border with you tonight. Drinking tequila, taking chances.
It's Full Flavored Radio, Barbecue Nation with JT. On FM News 101.
Hey, welcome back to The Nation. That would be Barbecue Nation here on the Radio Northwest Network. You know, you can email us at Barbecue Nation. That would be the letters BBQ Nation at KXL.com. And you can also do the same with recipes at KXL.com. We'd like to thank a couple of our affiliates really quick. KPNW in Eugene and KWVR in Enterprise. And then you can go to our Facebook page. I'm not a big Facebook guy, but David's got it set up for us there, and it is, Barbecue Nation on Facebook.
Yep, just type in Barbecue Nation in the search on Facebook.
There you go. So you've got everything you need to know about us, I guess. We're talking with Wayne Mueller today from Louis Mueller Barbecue down in Taylor, Texas. Wayne, since you took over, have you made any major changes to the menu there?
You know, we've added a few pork products, but I think our biggest change came about 5 years ago, going on 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I switched our beef rib cut again. Beef ribs are actually the longest standing menu item we have. We used to, you know, break down quarter and half carcasses in the meat market.
Sure.
And so we always had ribs of some sort. And we switched out of a chuck rib, or I switched us out of a chuck rib in 2010 to a plate rib, and it seemingly has been one of the better moves I've made since taking over from my father.
There you go.
Yeah. We've added some pork. We've added some baby back ribs, some pulled pork, really mostly to accommodate many of our southern guests who are just more comfortable in a pork world.
Yeah. Oh, I understand that, yeah. So, talk to us a little bit about, I'm going to ask you about Fred Fontaine pretty soon here, but I want to talk about you. And did you come in and change any of the rubs or, you know, the side sauces or anything like that? Have you messed with those at all?
No, the rubs are, you know, I believe in the simplistic model that my grandfather set in place, you know, 67 years ago. I'm all about the salt and pepper on a beef.
Mm-hmm.
I believe his philosophy of beef being robust, can stand on its own. Really, the only accents of salt and pepper used seem to be a natural folding of flavor, taste, and texture. So I believe in that simplistic view. I haven't changed any of that.
Okay.
Process has changed a little bit, but really it's due more to discovery and technology than it does any philosophical change. We still use offset smokers. We still use all post-oak wood. We use horizontal convection flow pit designs. We use salt and pepper rub. We rotate, and, you know, we cook it over long duration. So we still wrap at certain times of the process, and all of those things are, I would say, sacrosanct.
Sure.
I'm not changing these things. If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Now, are you still using a brick pit?
I am.
Yeah.
It burned on us in 2013. It was the seventh such fire incident in that pit's history. This one, however, it flared up on us one morning. One of my assistants has overbuilt the fire. It was kind of gusty that morning. We had some embers jump the firewall and make it to the grease pan. And it went up. The steel was old and a bit warped, so we couldn't cut off the oxygen to starve the fire.
Yeah.
Fire department had to be called. And it burned hot and long enough that there's a bend in our stack near the ceiling. It nested, the fire nested up there in some grease. And it did so all day. You know, we were cleaning up the rest of the day. Everything seemed fine. But it wasn't. We reconstituted the fire later that night. We were closed the next day, so it burned for hours before the local police noticed. So, you know, it destroyed that pit, and it had to be rebuilt. But it was rebuilt.
Was it rebuilt exactly the same with the same airflow dynamics and stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
And when I make new pits, which will be coming in the upcoming months, we'll be creating more pits on that same design.
Okay. Now, did my homework properly while you were cleaning up for that? You did you were using a stainless steel pit out behind there on a temporary basis. What did you find that you liked or didn't like about that?
Well, it wasn't a stainless pit. It was a mobile pit.
Okay.
It was a cold rolled steel pit, and it's a hybrid between a vertical flow and a horizontal flow. It's a very large chamber. It's an offset pit, but the airflow dynamics are completely different than what we were accustomed to. I had this pit for about a year, but I primarily used it for traveling and cooking on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And not to use in such a heavy capacity. It could handle it, but it took a little, reverse engineering and a little, I guess, mental imagery to understand the fluid dynamics of that.
Okay. I just find that kind of, as a guy who barbecues myself, I just found that kind of interesting because...
Oh, sure. And the crazy thing about that was we had to pull most of our meats from that pit, and we were closed after the fire for 1 week just to reset, clean, and to do our best to figure out this pit,
mm-hmm.
how we're going to configure it every day based on our par load. And a week later, Texas Monthly, the food editor and barbecue editor, came in for their 5-year stop for evaluation on ranking their top 50 barbecue establishments.
Sure.
So, you know, not only were we trying to recover from a fire, but we're trying to learn a new piece of equipment, really. And we're going to get judged and held under judgment for the next 5 years based on what we produced that day. So it was an interesting day.
I bet it was. We're going to take another break here on the Barbecue Nation. We're going to be back with Wayne Mueller in just a few minutes from Louis Mueller's in Taylor, Texas. And I'm going to talk to him about Fred Fontaine. And I think you might find this interesting. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a minute.
Somebody had curled my hair. Oh, I ain't going down on the border with you tonight. Drinking tequila, taking chances on our lives. All the women.
Mamas, don't let your babies grow.
It's a Northwest Lifestyle Weekend. Now, with Barbecue Nation, here's JT on FM News 101.
Don't let your babies grow up to be
cowboys. Welcome back to Barbecue Nation here on the Radio Northwest Network. I'm JT, along with David Shurtleff, master producer and talent extraordinaire there. We've got Wayne Mueller on here from Louis Mueller's, is named after his grandfather, in Taylor, Texas here. I was always wondering if, you know, kind of I switch careers from cowboy to barbecue guy. I was wondering if we could change the lyrics in that song to Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be pit masters. So,
amen.
I don't know. Yeah, that might work. Yeah, that might work. excuse me. Fred Fontaine. Yeah, I read about him, and of course I've never had the chance to meet him, but Tell us about Fred Fontaine a little bit, would you, Wayne? It's a real interesting story, I think.
Fred was from the Northeast. He fought in World War II. After the war, he found his way with one of his platoon mates. He found his way to Taylor, literally on the train. Fresh from the train, he walked over to my grandfather's grocery store and asked for a job. My grandfather gave him a job working in the grocery store. He already had somebody cooking on the pit. Actually, it had gone through a couple of people. They're trying to figure it out. He's trying to figure out how he wants to run it, what he wants to do. And so guy quit one day, and my grandfather asked Fred if he wanted to do it. He said, yep, okay. He laid out sort of, here's the parameters of what I want you to do. This is what we're going to be doing. Show me what you can do. So he just started cooking the meats that were sent out his way. And over time, just, you know, you put enough time into things, you get better and better. And eventually they really established a clientele. They established a fairly stable menu. And Fred really sort of took some ownership of what was going on in that little shack behind the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1959, a building across the street, mid-block over, became available. My grandfather took the lease on it and moved the restaurant operations, the barbecue restaurant operations, from the alleyway to the location where we currently reside. And Fred was with us here until probably 86, 87. He spent many a year here under long employ of my grandfather my father.
He's kind of an icon. I mean, really, if you kind of study barbecue history, especially in Texas and that, his name popped up a few times. And I was like, who is this guy, you know? And
yeah, you know, it's kind of funny because he used to joke about being, you know, the Yankee Texas barbecuer. he was French, and so his running buddies, I guess his bowling buddies, called him the Flying Frenchman. He had a unique quality about him in that he had a hearing aid. His eardrum was damaged in the war, but it was one of these old, like, earbox kind of hearing aids where the hearing box is actually located on his chest.
Oh,
and
wow.
It ran by a cord up to, you know, like an old transistor radio earbud into his ear. So I didn't know he had a hearing problem when I first met him, and I didn't know until I saw him answer the phone for the first time, because he picked up the phone, and instead of putting the earpiece next to his ear, he turned the phone upside down and put the earpiece onto his chest and was talking, and I thought he was just messing with me. I had no idea. And that's when I found out that he had a hearing aid. But he was a grizzly sort of guy, very, very gregarious, outgoing. He had favorites. He had ways of showing favoritism and ways of showing dissatisfaction. If he wasn't too keen on you, he'd still come over and say hello to you, shake your hand, full of grease, and then in your white dress shirt, slap you on the back a couple of times, make sure he left a couple of paw prints on you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Character, man.
Oh, that's.
But you know, I he and my grandfather went round and round. They fought tooth and nail over the introduction of brisket to the menu. Fred didn't want it. My grandfather did. Fred didn't think anybody would buy it. And so this was an argument that ensued for about a year. Finally, Fred relented because, you know, how are you not?
Yes.
And he started working with it. And I think that, you know, applying the parameters my grandfather was looking for, Fred was able to really come up with a process that worked really well.
Now,
the process has been in some form of evolution, you know, then for the next 20, 25 years, there's been tweaking. And even today, that still continues based on, you know, what we have available to us. But what he set in motion was something special.
Now, before you were doing the brisket, you were doing clod, right?
Yeah, we did clod. we did some clawed, but we were still doing just whatever large cuts we could get a hold of that were cheaper. So you did some roasts as well. You did some clawed. You rarely did any of center strips. You never did any of the high-cut meat.
Mm-hmm.
That changed probably in the 70s. My father reintroduced club steaks, which were fairly popular back in the 60s for us. We've considered reintroducing mutton. It was very popular for us until we moved into our current location. The menu's changed.
So Wayne, let me ask you, was it your grandfather or was it Fred or was it a result of the battle between the two of them where they came up with the wrapping the brisket?
This was an ongoing thing about how to even handle this.
Uh-huh.
And it was in full collaboration between the two. My grandfather would really inform Fred, here are the things that I want you to try, and then bring these back to me and let me know. Let's gauge how these are going.
Sure.
And so this went back and forth, for quite a number of months before my grandfather was finally happy with where we were going with it. And it really was the simplicity of the bark. I mean, we started out with a very light dusting, and today our salt and pepper rub is a bark. It's an encrusting mutt.
Mm-hmm.
It's heavily laden with pepper, and it wasn't that way initially. So that sort of evolved. That's also sort of evolved because of the wrapping that we do. Now, our wrapping really comes more at the very end and the resting period, the rest and hold period. That process has been extended and augmented today. Many people will wrap earlier in the process, still during the cooking process and the rendering process. We don't do that because our bark characteristic is one that we are very happy with,
mm-hmm.
one that's sort of uniquely ours. And wrapping would tend to change those characteristics.
That's interesting. Now, what do you? We've got a couple minutes left before we got to go to break here. But how do you place them on hold? I mean, they tell you, if you watch one of the shows on TV or if you watch Steve Reichlin or one of those, you put them in a cooler. I'm sure you probably don't put them in a Coleman cooler out there, do you?
No, but we use the same principle. I don't use a dynamic heating environment to rest my brisket. I'm not trying to add more heat. What I'm trying to do is just hold on to the heat that I have
mm-hmm.
and step it down very slowly over a long period of time. It's no different than resting any meat after it's cooked on a counter, except you're just doing it in a more protected way. I'm not letting the steam leave,
right?
Which holds in a lot of heat, and I'm not letting really the rendered fat go anywhere either. I'm forcing it all to stay where it is. And I do that in a very passive environment, which is an insulated environment. We use transportation units, Cambro units,
okay,
that we can slide pans in and out of.
Okay.
Then we allow the interior heat of each individually packaged brisket to hold that temperature at 160, 165.
Sure.
And it'll rest there for 2, 3, maybe even 4 hours.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a break here. We're going to be back and wrap up the show with Wayne Mueller from Louis Mueller's in Texas. All I'm doing is getting hungry. That's all I can tell you. We'll be back in just a minute.
Don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive their old trucks. Let them be doctors and lawyers and such. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good time.
It's Barbecue Nation with Jeff Tracy.
Welcome back to Barbecue Nation here on the Radio Northwest Network. I'm JT along with David Shurtleff. We've got Wayne Mueller on with us today from Louis Mueller's in Taylor, Texas. By the way, I wanted to tell you, if you were going down south this weekend or headed down the freeway, hang a left there at Woodburn. Go over and see my pals at Barclays, you know, Mark and Jamie and the crew there. Tell them I said to give you a discount on something. That'll really make their noses curl. Anyway, that's Barclays on 99E, south of Woodburn there. Wayne, I got a quick question. Do you enjoy, and I know it's a business, and I know, you know, you're doing television and you're doing this, and they've filmed movies there at Louis Mueller's and all this, but do you actually enjoy getting up and going to the pits in the morning?
Physically, it's harder some mornings than it is others.
Uh-huh.
But actually, yeah, putting on my alchemist robe every morning, it's pretty awesome, really. It gives me a little time alone. I have an hour before my apprentice comes in.
Uh-huh.
I intentionally set it that way, so I have a little time to myself in this place. It's sort of a zen period for me.
Sure.
I get to, you know, I have conversations with primarily my father. You know, we share a cup of coffee and talk.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, things that are going on and, you know, how would he handle these sorts of things? Because the blessing that I really have is, you know, my father and I, we knew each other really, you know, not only disciplinarian, but, you know, and boss, but I didn't get to know him as a man until I came back.
Right.
A year and a half before he passed. And it was during that year and a half that I really began to understand the man and what drove him and why this was important to him, and to begin to appreciate that in a whole different level in a way that I hadn't seen it before. So because of that, and because of, you know, I think truly my dedication to him, this is a labor of love. It's really about him.
I understand that completely. Is there anything you want to do or that you keep toying with that, you know, people might see on the menu in the next 6 months or year? Or is that just an ongoing process for you?
Well, you know, we do a lot of festivals, and everybody does the same base meats, brisket, sausage, ribs of some sort. In order to, you know, sort of distinguish yourself, you need to do some different things. And we have people who like to be experimental, and I'm one of those. So lately, this last year, we've introduced some smoked and braised lamb.
Mm-hmm.
That has gone over extremely well. We braise it in a jalapeno sauce that we created here that is so against the grain of who we typically are. I mean, my grandfather would say, if people walk out of the door talking about how good your barbecue sauce is, you failed. Because remember where you are. We're not in the Carolinas. We're in Central Texas. Here it's about beef. It's not about pork. And therefore, it should stand alone. It doesn't require access to bring it to its full bouquet.
Right.
And so remember, he was very adamant. If they're using sauce on your meat, then you screwed it up because they have to cover something to make it edible. And that really imprinted upon me the idea of being a non-sauce culture. So developing sauces for things would be almost antithetical to our philosophical belief. But I guess only insofar as it would be used in a beef context. We really don't use it in a beef context.
Yeah.
But, you know, lamb is still a red meat, so I don't know how we'd feel about that, to be honest with you.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes left here, but don't you think, I mean, that as the time has passed and the restaurant has gotten more notoriety, that you have to kind of accommodate people coming through too. Like you said earlier, Southern people coming through, they're more into pork dishes. They probably have a little more orientation towards sauces and things like that.
Certainly. And, you know, I recognize that fully. And I think in order to be successful, you really have to mirror your guest, your clientele. And if you're not offering them things, in addition to what you do well, at least some transitionary menu items, things that they feel familiar with, then you may lose people. I want to be at least an open environment that gives our people a chance to, you know, spread their wings a little bit, and we get to work with meats that we didn't typically work with before, and and learn how to get better with that.
There you go. Wayne Mueller from Louis Mueller's in Taylor, Texas. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Wayne. I really enjoyed it.
Likewise, JT. Thanks for having me on.
You betcha. Folks, we'll be back next week with another edition of Barbecue Nation. Until then, go out and grill something.